A key phrase in the Torah reading that we'll read tomorrow has at its heart the word ra'eh, see. See, I have set before you this day life and good, death and evil. In that, I command you this day to love Adonai your God, to walk in his ways and keep his commandments and statutes and judgments, that you may live and multiply, and Adonai your God will bless you in the land which you are entering to possess. These two verses clearly indicate that we have free will. When I talk about theodicy, which is the discipline of theology that addresses the question of evil and tragedy, I often skip over the human evil question. Where was humanity at Auschwitz is the question that I ask. And then I move on to the very difficult question of acts of natural tragedy, acts of God, which I spoke about on Rosh Hashanah. But human evil is a very real question, especially after the most recent acts in Charlottesville and Barcelona, along with other acts of hatred around the world and in our own country. I remember watching the tape and horror of that young woman being killed in Charlottesville, and the reaction of everyone was, oh my God, oh my God. Judaism understands this in a way that I think has it exactly right. It teaches that we have two impulses, a Yetzer Tov, an impulse to do good, and a Yetzer Hara, the impulse to evil. Or more precisely, Hara meaning the impulse to selfishness, self-gratification, violation of God's commandment. A psychologist might call it the id. The rabbinic tradition teaches the impulse to evil is sweet in the beginning and bitter in the end. The sages say that the impulse to evil is at least 13 years older than the impulse to good. The idea being you have the impulse to evil as soon as you're born, and it takes till the age of bar bat mitzvah for you to get some control over it. To be sure, the Holy One created the impulse to evil, the Talmud teaches, but he also created the Torah as an antidote. There's a story in the Talmud of one day the rabbis were able to trap the Yetzer Hara, trapped this impulse for self-gratification, for evil, for selfishness. And they were very proud till they noticed nobody went to work the next day. Nobody cared about making a living. The sexual impulse died. Even the hens weren't laying eggs. Nothing was happening. And so they wondered, and they asked God, can't we just tone down the Yetzer Hara a little bit? And God said, sorry, take it or leave it. And here we are, reluctantly, they set free the Yetzer Hara. Another important insight is that humans, and humans alone, have free will. The Talmud teaches all is foreseen, yet free will is given. Maybe God knows what we're going to do, but we have the ability to choose life and good or death and curse. The Talmud asks, who is mighty? And answers, the one who subdues his Yetzer Hara. We can understand the Garden of Eden as a parable, that you can't have free will in theory, you actually have to use it. You know, you think about the story in the Garden of Eden. They put this tree right in the center where nobody can miss it, and they tell the first man and woman, you can eat anything, oh, don't eat that one. I always think of this as like a parent's leaving for the night, your kids are getting older, you trust them, they're good kids, and you tell them, you know, they're 12 and 10, yeah, that there's food in the microwave, or you're, you know, there's a good movie you can watch on the DVD, and we trust you. You know, here's a cell number, no problem. Oh, by the way, don't look in mom's upper left-hand drawer. So how long before you pull that out of the driveway before the kids are looking in mom's upper left-hand drawer? And for me, the more interesting question is, would you want to have kids who would not look in the upper left-hand drawer? Notice that Judaism gives us the free will. It doesn't substitute Satan as an outside force. So I think Judaism has it exactly right. We have a primal impulse to amoral or even immoral self-gratification. And we also have an impulse to do good things. They're at war with each other. Religion and ethics are, in my opinion, in my view, the only hope. You know, everything that Hitler did was legal. Hitler broke no laws. Everything was legal according to the laws of Germany. So there's got to be a source of law beyond what is legal or popular. David Zaslow put together some fake news. This is fake news, I want to warn you, fake news, retrojecting it in the past. Today, August 1st, 1944, the Jews started what is called the Warsaw Uprising. Now, as president of Poland, I must be honest. What the Nazis have done is bad, very bad. They have some bad, bad people. But if you watch the news, and I watch the news a lot, there was violence on both sides. I saw it myself, even though the fake news want to just blame the Nazis. The Nazis have some bad people, but the Jews have some too. There's blame on many sides. I saw the Jews coming at the Nazis with sticks, and I remember the Nazis were there legally. As president of Poland, I issued them a permit, but the Jews did not have a permit to be violent. I condemn all violence. There's got to be a standard of good and evil beyond what the president says. Human nature, even absent the theology, is tribal for good Darwinian survival reasons. You know, our tribe needed to conquer your tribe to get your land, your food, your women. This is the way we grew as animals. The Torah said we're created in the divine image, but God also says, let us create humanity in our image. So created in the divine image, Yetzer Tov, and also in the image of animals, Yetzer Hara. The question is, can we overcome this animal drive? We Jews have a special stake in the question of human hatred, its understanding and elimination. As many have noted, hatred of Jews, anti-Semitism, serves as the canary in the coal mine, an early predictor of more widespread hatred to be unleashed. After all, supposedly good people peaceably gathering to protest removal of Confederate statues in Virginia were shouting, "Jews will not replace us," and they were threatening the local synagogue. Here's an account of what happened at the synagogue that day. The president of the synagogue stood before the small congregation gathered for Shabbat services and issued this warning: "Leave from the back door and be sure to leave in groups. Outside, neo-Nazis and KKK members gathered for the hate-filled rally. Shouts of 'There's the synagogue' could be heard and salutes of 'Sieg Heil.' For 30 minutes, three men dressed in fatigues and carrying semi-automatic weapons stood across the street from the synagogue. Nazi flags were paraded past its doors. The Charlottesville police refused the synagogue's request to station at least one officer outside. The congregation hired a private security guard instead." So it's worth taking a little closer look at the question of anti-Semitism. We read the news, we read history, and we wonder in amazement about how many people in the world still believe that Jews were behind the World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks. Why? Why seemingly normal young people would blow themselves up in order to murder innocent women, men, women, and children in a cafe, restaurant, bus, even at a Pesach dinner. Why? Why Palestinian TV shows highlight the dreams of apparently sweet young children to grow up to kill Jews? Why in the Gulf War, the first war, when Iraq attacked Kuwait and an Arab Western alliance responded, Iraq responded by sending Scud missiles, not into the troops, but into Israel? Why in the final months of World War II, the Nazis placed the continuing murder of Jews at an even higher priority than winning the war, dedicating rail cars and assets to keeping the death camps going? How ordinary God-fearing Germans could throw live babies into the crematoria, their goal being very efficient analysts, determined that they didn't have to waste 1/2 cent of gas in murdering babies. Why Christian crusaders on their way to free the Holy Land from the Muslim infidels 1,000 years ago would murder Jews in the cities they passed on their way. Why church fathers and saints, including Martin Luther, and Enlightenment philosophers, including Voltaire, would write anti-Jewish diatribes that you would think could only come from the pen of a Nazi. If you ask around, you'll get many reasons for anti-Semitism: scapegoating, ethnic hatred, xenophobia, resentment of affluence, professional success, and religious bigotry. But it's still pretty hard to fathom why this constant hatred, why for so long, and why it's only Jews that seem to be the target. Rich Jews, poor Jews, powerful Jews, weak Jews, religious Jews, secular Jews. You know, it's only in the last 100 years or so that Jews have had a difficult time understanding the reason for anti-Semitism. Over 100 years ago, all Jews understood the reason for anti-Semitism quite clearly. The reason is Judaism. It's Jewish beliefs. The Jews' allegiance to God, Torah, and Israel. Our reason for existence, to change the world for the better. Our idea that we're selected for this difficult task. And the better quality of life as a result of Judaism. It's Judaism. As a result, Jews could escape anti-Semitism throughout history by converting away from Judaism to whatever the majority culture would be. The Nazis were the single exception to this rule. Thus, anti-Semitism is unlike other forms of racial or ethnic prejudice. If I had to summarize the reason succinctly, I would say that Jews are the messengers to the world of a universal set of ethics. God rules, not Caesar, not the emperor, not the church, not the dictator, not the Führer, not even the public will. It's God's rule that counts. When the moral conscience slumbers, we are the world's alarm clock, and nobody likes their alarm clock. Let's look for a moment at some of the major historical thrusts of anti-Semitism. Christian anti-Semitism. Jesus was a Jew who came to preach to Jews. By rejecting the messiahship and divinity of Jesus, the very existence of Jews was an affront to Christian legitimacy. The Christian response was to deny the legitimacy of Jews. The church was now Israel. The authors of the New Testament had to discredit Judaism, with whom they were competing. That's the origin of the anti-Semitism in Christian scriptures, and there are many examples of it. Church fathers, even ancient ones, St. John Chrysostom, laid the theological justification for violence against the Jews. As I mentioned, during the Crusades, a mission to capture the Holy Land from the Jews, when found, the Crusaders would say, "Why do we have to wait till we're in the Holy Land to kill infidels? We have them right here." When found, the Jews were often offered conversion or death. These Christian roots made the Holocaust possible. Nazism was not Christian, it was anti-Christian. But Christian anti-Semitism made the Holocaust possible. Nazi anti-Jewish laws used medieval church law as their models. Martin Luther was originally critical of the church's anti-Jewish policies because he believed they prevented Jews from converting from Catholicism to Lutheranism. When the Jews didn't convert to that form of Christianity, his rhetoric became so venomous that the Nazis used it as a defense at the Nuremberg trials. The first Nazi pogrom, Kristallnacht, was held in honor of Luther's birthday. Islamic anti-Semitism. Historically, Jews were treated better by Muslims than Christians. In his early years, Muhammad related well to the Jews. When the Jews rejected Islam, he condemned them. Jews and Christians were afforded better treatment than pagans, but they still, under Muslim law, had to be submissive. The Arabic term is dhimnis. Most Christian communities under Islam disappeared. Jews survived and often thrived. Judaism as a religion is not a threat to Islam, but the Jews' refusal to be subordinated is. The state of Israel is, since it's inconsistent with the views of Jews as humiliated or wretched. But even in the Enlightenment, there was anti-Semitism. Voltaire was a horrible anti-Semite. And leftist anti-Semitism was focused on the national element of Judaism, that we are a people in addition to being a religion. Jews were okay in this view as long as we would give up this national component of Judaism and become just a religion like Christianity. But this would not be Judaism. Nazi anti-Semitism was the only one where Jews did not have the option to convert. It wasn't simply racism. You could say they were just racist, but they were anti-Semitic against Jews. Arabs are also Semites. The Arabs didn't give the Nazis any problems. Japanese were certainly not Aryans, but they were allies of Nazi Germany. And it wasn't simply scapegoats. Murdering Jews seemed to be a higher priority than winning the war itself. Hitler's final message to his people was as follows: "Above all, I charge the leaders of the nation and those under them to scrupulous observance of the laws of race and to the merciless opposition of the universal poisoner of all peoples, international Jewry." 6 million Jews, 1 million children, more than half of Europe's Jews, and more than 80% of rabbis and full-time students of Judaism were murdered in the Holocaust. And the local populations cooperated. Where nations refused to cooperate, Jews were saved, such as in Denmark and Morocco. My wife, Sonia, is from Morocco, as many of you know, and her parents and grandparents would tell the story that when the Nazis ordered Morocco, that by then a conquered country, to send its Jews, the king of Morocco said, "I have no Jews, I only have subjects," and none were sent. But where local governments cooperated, such as in Poland, 90% of Jews were murdered. Could it happen again? There are many examples, psychological experiments, such as the Milgram experiment, which suggests that ordinary people have this capability within them. It wasn't that the Nazis were some sort of horrible, bestial form of humanity. We all have this Yetzer Hara within us. So what's the message to us? Should we give up this risky religion of ours? Wouldn't we be safer, happier as Christians, as atheists, as nothing? No. God has given us a mission, one our ancestors accepted 100 generations ago at Sinai, to teach the world about God and God's ethics, and not to give up when the world seems to get it wrong. The world need not be Jewish, but it must be ethical. When the world's ethics slip, they come after the Jews first. The good news is that it's working, our work in the world. The danger to Jewish survival today in this country is not that we're hated, but that we're loved. Literally, Christians want to marry us. The result is the same. I am optimistic on this. In the bad old days, Jews were offered the choice: expulsion, conversion, or death. Only those Jews with some powerful attachment to Judaism would give up their homes, get on a ship, and go somewhere, literally placing their lives in the hands of ship's captains to leave their country and wind up someplace where they had no sense of where they were even going. They were obsessed with holding on to their Judaism. Others converted and some were killed. Today, the biggest threat is join us, marry us. As before, only those with a powerful, some might say illogical or obsessive allegiance to Judaism will remain Jews. Thank God we don't face death or expulsion. Major progress in the world has been made. For the first time in more than 2,000 years, since the time of the Maccabees, there is a free and independent Jewish state with the will and power to protect Jews worldwide. And every time there's a natural disaster in the world, Israeli hospitals and forces are there first. We need to support Israel through donations, bonds, etc. I mentioned last week, and I want to reiterate, we're planning about a year from now an interfaith trip to Israel, which I will be leading. Actual anti-Semitism is unacceptable in polite society and international discourse. It's often masked as anti-Zionism. We're not against Jews, we're only against Israel. It's as though someone were saying, "I'm not against French people, it's just there should be no nation of France." Christianity has fundamentally changed. Through Vatican II and other statements, Catholics and most other Christian denominations have stated that God's covenant with Jews is intact, that Jews need not convert to Christianity, and that the anti-Semitism of the New Testament is rejected, including claims of deicide, that the Jews were responsible for Jesus' death. And I think it's sometimes hard for us to understand what a major change this is for Christianity. What Christianity has to say about Hinduism or Buddhism is interesting. What Christianity has to say about Judaism is foundational. And Christianity has reversed its course 180 degrees on that. I speak to more Christians than Jews because I wrote a book for Christians about Judaism. I've had many wonderful experiences on a Lufthansa flight, wearing my yarmulke, being called to pray with a group of Orthodox Jews, stopping service on the German national airline while 10 Jews pray in the aisle in a small plane. I was in Israel, in Jerusalem, when the president of Germany was escorted by an armed Israeli honor guard to speak at the Knesset. In wearing my yarmulke, as I do most of the time, I've never had a bad experience, but I have had many experiences where people come up to me to let me know how much they support Jews and Israel. There has never been a better, freer time to be Jewish, but much remains to be done. Muslim and leftist anti-Semitism is the biggest concern these days. Much remains to be done in repairing the world. We have not yet achieved our mission, and most importantly, we have not yet achieved controlling our Yetzer Hara, as the rest of the world has not yet achieved it in discourse, in both in words and in deeds. There's a Cherokee legend, a Native American legend. A grandfather is talking to his grandson, and he says, there are two wolves inside of us, which are always at war with each other. One of them is a good wolf, which represents things like kindness, bravery, and love. The other is a bad wolf, which represents things like greed, hatred, and fear. The grandson stops and thinks about it a second, then looks up at his grandfather and says, Grandfather, which one wins? The grandfather quietly replies, the one you feed. Perhaps Yom Kippur is a day in which we can learn not to feed this wolf or anything else for at least one day. Martin Luther King said, we must accept finite disappointment, but never lose infinite hope. And so, as we enter this solemn day of fasting, introspection, and prayer, let us not forget that God sent us here on a mission to complete the divine work of creation. And the work begins with us, to work in our own human natures. Talmud says, Lo alecha hamlacha likmor. It's not up to you to complete the task. V'lo ata ben chorin lehevatel mimena. But no one is exempt from participating. My family and I wish you and yours a tzom kal, an easy fast, but also lots of hard work in making this new year and the world that we, this new year and the world, one that we and God can be proud of. Ken Yehi Ratzon, may this be God's will.